precious tradition were not extended to these two great majorities, the lower classes in England and the non-English speaking masses throughout the world, if this precious tradition were not extended to these two great majorities, the minority of upper class Englishmen would ultimately be submerged with these majorities and the tradition lost. To prevent this, the tradition must be extended to the masses and to the empire. In short, we superior people got to make them all like us. We got that moral duty. Now, once you believe that, you become committed to religious fervor. That's why the Jimmy Swaggerts want to stop you from smoking cigars, growing tobacco. Same thing. That's why all these fundamentalist Christians want to change us into their image. They got an argument that comes from Isaiah instead of Ruskin. If you warn them in their wicked ways, God will not require their blood at your hands. But if you don't warn them, God will require their blood at your hand. Now, it happens to be a wrong application of the verse, but that's why people jogging through the park and see you taking a nice Sunday nap on a bench, wake you up and try to save you. They can't jog by you for fear your blood will be at their hands. Well, you know, I don't want to leave me and my blood sleeping. But they have this moral duty. Now, all I'm really pleading for is the ability to see what Jesus tried to make the stone throwers see. When they caught the woman in adultery, taken in the very act. Caught in the very act. Now we have South Africa, caught in the very act. Now you can say they've been doing it for 300 years. I'm telling you, the woman is doing something that's been done much longer than 300 years. You got two choices now. Unless it's an orgy. Stoner? What about her now? With stones in her hand. Jesus says, he that's without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her. That cooled him off in a hurry. Stone started dropping. Am I boring you? It's after midnight. Every one of you have had more sleep than I. You see, we had self-righteous judgments for slavery. I haven't got around to it yet, but I'm still going to raise the question to those who believe in the inerrant word of God. What are you going to do about Philemon? That's Paul's message on slavery. Be a good slave. He didn't say, shoot your master. He said, be a good slave. And he wrote to the master and said, be good to him now and forgive him because he ran away, because I'm sending him back home. Philemon was a favorite verse of Scripture in there, a favorite book in the Bible. In the pre-Civil War South. Sorry. You know, I'm still sort of waking people up to the fact that God did not lay the King James down on Mount Sinai and say every jot and tittle thereof must be kept forever by everybody in every circumstance. I'm trying to get us to look at South Africa individual. You have a right to be liked or disliked because of who you are, and to be understood for who you are, and then taken from where you are in a direction that isn't as much coerced or self-determinative. To project our view onto South Africa per se is just a different kind of the same thing that they're being criticized for. A certain group forcing its viewpoint on another. But let's continue here. Unless this tradition, the possessors of this tradition, could extend what they had, unless it was recognized as a moral issue, and now it suddenly got too hot in here. As possessors of a magnificent tradition of education, beauty, rule of law, freedom, decency, and self-discipline, this tradition could not be saved, didn't deserve to be saved, unless it could be extended to the lower caste classes in England itself and to the non-English classes, non-English masses throughout the world. If this precious tradition were not extended to these two great majorities, the minority of upper-class Englishmen would ultimately be submerged by these majorities and the tradition lost. To prevent this, the tradition must be extended to the masses and to the empire. Now, how do you like that idea? Doesn't it sound self-righteous? Now, I want you to know there are a lot of people in South Africa that had gone through this and came back with a counter-argument. They said, no, this is wrong. This is wrong. We should not try to make little Englishmen out of everybody, black, red, yellow, white, and blue. But we should respect the individual culture of each group and create an opportunity for this divergence to develop, just like we provide reservations for the American Indians, so their culture can be preserved. As long as they don't try to claim the whole state of Maine. As long as they don't remind us of some of our past agreements. Now, if you will just for a moment realize that some people decided, particularly as Dutchmen, they didn't want to be transformed into little Englishmen. And their argument is the right of indigenous development, including their own language. Many people think South Africa is just a bunch of English-speaking brands of Englishmen. The Afrikaners speak Afrikaans. What's going to be taught in the schools? What's going to be the language in which the political affairs are discussed? And if you were there and thought God sent you there and you fled Europe, and the oppression of the Protestants under the Catholic Inquisition. What in the world is going on back there? I mean, I stir things up. Something fell, I guess. Just make sure nothing's broke and leave it alone and come back. Fix it later. If you see smoke coming out of that, holler at me. Now, listen to me. If you were a Dutchman, and you were suddenly confronted by little Englishmen determined to make you like them, and you fought a war, and you believed that 25,000 year women and children were put in a concentration camp and fed, ground glass, deliberately murdered, you wouldn't have such a highfalutin idea, would you, of these English people? South Africa is not English. The Afrikaners do not want to be English. They feel God gave them this country. Their forebears took the Bible, and they've been taught since youth, and it doesn't matter whether it's historically accurate or not. Some of you have been taught things about the Bible you're finding aren't very true about the Bible itself. You've been taught the youth up that the Dutch and the blacks arrived in the territory at the same time. The Dutch just happened to be led of God to prevail. Now the English want to cram their way down your throat. Your defense against that is the right of indigenous development. Then it works so well, you suddenly become part of the in crowd. You don't have to be a little Englishman. It becomes a nice rationale to keep the blacks from crowding in on you too. They need indigenous development opportunity. Now, the point I'm making is both of them are rationales for what you want to do in the first place. That's the point. You just basically are a sinner who wants what you want for yourself, and most people are like the two brothers that got the chance to choose cats. There were two cats, a very nice Siamese cat and a ratty old alley cat. And the first brother grabbed the Siamese cat and said, "Now you choose." That's human nature. But after you have the Siamese cat and watch the other fellow live with his little old dog-eared alley cat, you begin to rationalize, "God put me there to pick that cat up first." That's the way you live with yourself. Let's go back to the English. It's part of the roots of the problem. If this precious tradition were, you see, Christian philosophy enables you to understand about anything. If this precious tradition were not extended to these two great majorities, poor English and non-English masses, the minority of upper class Englishmen would ultimately be submerged by these majorities and the tradition lost. And it is God's stewardship, this treasure of culture and education and art and blah, blah, blah. Maybe it's true. Maybe it isn't. To prevent the loss of it, the tradition must be extended to the masses and to the empire. Ruskin's message had a sensational impact. His inaugural lecture was copied out in longhand by one undergraduate, Cecil Rhodes, who kept it with him for 30 years. Rhodes, who lived from 1853 to 1902, feverishly exploited the diamonds and gold fields of South Africa, rose to be Prime Minister of the Cape Colony, contributed money to political parties, controlled parliamentary seats both in England and in South Africa, and sought to win a strip of British territory across Africa from the Cape of Good Hope to Egypt, and to join these two extremes together with a telegraph line and ultimately with a Cape to Cairo railway. Rhodes inspired devoted support for his goals from others in South Africa and in England, with financial support from Lord Rothschild and Alfred Beit. He was able to monopolize the diamond mines of South Africa as De Beers consolidated mines and to build up a great gold mining enterprise as consolidated gold fields. I lived in Oroville, 7 miles out to Cherokee, with a big old scar of a mountain that represents one of the finest diamond reserve discoveries in the United States ever found, accompanying the gold discoveries that produce the rock piles and ultimately the big Oroville Dam that feeds water here to Southern California. Cherokee is a ghost town. I go out there to quail hunt, to hike around, look at that big jagged gash in the Table Mountain country where initial mining started and stopped because the South African gold mine got the option on it for so many years nobody could mine it and be in competition with them. I live there close to it. In the middle 1890s, Rhodes had a personal income of at least £1 million sterling a year. It's about $5 million then, when dollars meant something. No taxes. Which was spent so freely for his mysterious purposes. He was like that priest in South France. $5 million a year in the 1890s that he spent so freely for his mysterious purposes, he was usually overdrawn on his account. These purposes centered on his desire to federate the English-speaking peoples and bring all the habitable portions of the world under their control. That's a rather grand enterprise. For this purpose, Rhodes left part of his great fortune to found the Rhodes Scholarship at Oxford, in order to spread the English ruling class tradition throughout the English-speaking world as Ruskin had wanted. Now, when the media hypes, the advantage of a Rhodes Scholarship. How many of these bleeding heart liberals tell you what the Rhodes Scholarship is designed to achieve? To spread the English ruling class tradition throughout the English-speaking world as Ruskin had wanted. How many of you knew that? How many didn't know it? Well, everybody wants a Rhodes Scholarship. I mean, you put that on your resume, Rhodes Scholar. I mean, that's going to get you, if you happen to be a law graduate, Rhodes Scholar. Even makes a songwriter appear a little more dignified that he happened to be a Rhodes Scholar. In order to spread the English ruling class tradition throughout the English-speaking world as Ruskin had wanted. Got to hand it to the old boy. There's nothing like a sense of moral destiny to keep the energy flowing. No war is as hot as a holy war. He copied Ruskin's lecture in longhand. That became his moral imperative. He had to make $5 million a year and be overdrawn every year because he had this duty. Otherwise, the wondrous things that he had no right to be preserved. Same syndrome and rationales of robber barons in America. Among Ruskin's most devoted disciples at Oxford were a group of intimate friends, including Arnold Toynbee. You're going to hear names that are synonymous with progress in the English-speaking world. Alfred, later Lord Milner. Arthur Glazebrook, George, later Sir George Parkin. Philip Littleton Jell. And Henry, later Sir Henry Birchenough. These young men were so moved by Ruskin that they devoted the rest of their lives to carrying out his ideas. A similar group of Cambridge men, including Reginald Balliol Brett, Lord Esher, Sir John B. Seeley, Albert Lord Grey, and Edmund Garrett, were also aroused by Ruskin's message and devoted their lives to extension of the British Empire and uplift of England's urban masses as two parts of one project they called the Extension of the English-Speaking Idea. They were remarkably successful in these aims because England's most sensational journalist, William T. Stead, an ardent social reformer and imperialist, brought them into association with Rhodes. This association was formally established on February 5, 1891, when Rhodes and Stead organized a secret society of which Rhodes had been dreaming for 16 years. In this secret society, Rhodes was to be the leader. Stead, Brett, Lord Esher, and Milner were to form an executive committee. Arthur, Lord Balfour, of the Balfour Declaration that opened Israel to the Jews, and Sir Harry Johnston, Lord Rothschild, Albert Lord Grey, and others were listed as potential members of a circle of initiates, while there was to be an outer circle known as the Association of Helpers, later organized by Milner as the Round Table Organization, which in turn became the Round Table Organization of the United States, which in turn produced the Council on Foreign Relations, which in turn produced the Trilateral Commission. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Oh, it's just black and white issue, you know. Just one big old street fight, lance the boil and let it flow. You know, the social architects of communism tell you that individuality means nothing. They don't believe in immortality. We're just part of a stream, of a dialectic that must polarize and then clash in revolution, and the splash and guts and blood resynthesizes into something better. The only difference is the cells of a boil are not living souls, each with eternal and individualistic worth and meaning. An analogy like busting boils doesn't really apply to the lives of men, women, and children that are confronted with the choice of a little bit of patience while pressure achieves reason rather than an explosion and a holocaust of revolution and a bloodbath. You want me to continue on this?
Yes, sir.
Now, here's a good question from Memphis. Why is it that when revolutions occur, communists move in rather than democracies? Because communism as a philosophy teaches the necessity of revolution is a prelude to the new synthesis. They, therefore, are prepared for it. It's part of their working philosophy. They encourage it as the traumatic explosion in the dialectic process that forces the shattering of the polarizing of the previous synthesis into a new opportunity in the dialectic for the process to produce another polarization, another synthesis first, which leads to another polarization, which leads to another revolution, until ultimately the ideal society has reached their form of utopia that's never been demonstrated yet on Earth. Revolutions are part of their philosophy. They encourage it, and they're ready to take advantage of it. Democracies are not ready to take advantage of it. They're just reeling from the shock. But those who know the dialectic process have planned for it and seize the opportunity, and that's communism. Tallahassee called. Is it true that most of the blacks killed in South Africa have been killed by other blacks and colored peoples? Well, you mean recently, over the long run, or what? I need the date and the time, but I'm going to tell you that's what I think we need to find out, and not jump to any conclusions. McLean, Virginia. I knew Carol Quigley about 40 years ago at Georgetown University. He'd come to our fraternity, and he was a tough prof. When I hear Dr. Scott quote Dr. Quigley, I know he has to be right. Gene Scott's done a hell of a lot for me. I'd like to see Dr. Scott on primetime hours. Well, call your station. Manhattan Beach, I see a real parallel between what's happening in South Africa and the American Indian. What does Doc think? Well, that's what we're going to develop, so we'll see, won't we? I don't think Mr. Ruskin was ill-intentioned. I don't either. I think he was very sincere. That doesn't necessarily mean he was right. I think he was an admirable man who served his generation well. What works in one generation may not be true for the next generation. This is the generation of jet planes and potential nuclear holocaust and television, though South Africa didn't get television until 1976. Jerry Falwell threw in the sponge in that terrible, shameful debate that pitted a black preacher against a white preacher, and both of them reduced it down to race friction. It's a lot more complicated than that. Racial injustice is but one of many expressions of sin, which is simply to seek your own way, serve yourself first and others last, look out for number one, and then find a rationale for doing it. Statesmanship is needed that doesn't see color, sees injustice, but quits putting racist names on it and using that motivation to get decency and justice. Now, wouldn't it be something if we alone were able to just pull a Harry Truman? Wouldn't it be something if we alone were able to pull a Harry Truman? Take that map again and take a look at where we cover. Here's our spread across the nation. Thinking people who watch us all night long in some cities. Look at that West Coast. Head on up to Portland and above. Oh, no, no. Yeah. I want you to stay back. You're going the wrong direction. I want to be able to see that whole spread. Now go across the Texas and Oklahoma, and that cluster around Denver, head on across the South and up the East Coast and around Chicago, down in Florida, on up that heavy populated East Coast area. Wouldn't it be something if we and we alone could let our voice be heard sufficient that what everybody said was impossible happens? If it doesn't, we're still right. We're still right in urging sanity and restraint. We're not approving anything. But neither am I so prone. You know, I hate these speeches that by people that say, well, I'm against apartheid because they feel they have to be. I'm against apartheid because I know what it is. But a lot of those people say they're against it don't know what it is. I'm against it because I think it's the wrong philosophy. It is but a nationwide application of the philosophy of American Indian reservations. So I have answered that earlier question, though I didn't intend to. But, you know, if in order to have the chance to look things over to draw your own conclusion, you must somehow protect yourself against the bigots who are going to prejudge you before you even open your mouth, you must make the audience-serving statements first, you lose your case going out the gate. What did Falwell gain by answering Koppel? Well, I think that the sanctions are going to pass overwhelmingly. When you say something, you're going to fight harder to have it happen than if you hadn't said it. Never say die. If the sanction shouldn't pass, don't give up to the last hour. That's why I'm still here tonight. And, you know, I could hate South Africa and want to blow them off the map, which I don't. I just think that we're using a method counterproductively by overkilling. I mean, you know, I used to hunt pheasants. You know, I can hit a pheasant when it's flying out there and shoot him a second time before he hits the ground, then pick birdshot all the time trying to eat. I mean, when you got him, you got him. Don't overkill. Somebody call and says South Africa needs some teaching room. That's right. Nobody else is going to do it on TV. They don't think that you can afford to deal with roots and basic facts like this on television time. Well, I'm on all the time, so it doesn't matter to me. I'm searching for truth. Here's two dynamite quotes sent to me from Wichita, Kansas. Quotes from Abe Lincoln. By the way, do you know we've had the largest response these few nights to this we've ever had on anything when I didn't give a book away? I can't keep up with the messages. Abe Lincoln, two quotes from Carl Sandburg's book. It would do no good to go ahead any faster than the country would follow. Here's another one. The powder in this bombshell will keep dry, and when the fuse is lit, I intend to have them touch it off themselves. Now we know why he's considered one of the great presidents, don't we? Both of those would fit South Africa. It would do no good to go ahead any faster than the country would follow. The powder in this bombshell will keep dry, and when the fuse is lit, I intend to have them touch it off themselves. I think you ought to call your senator and give him this quote. Write it down now slowly. Put it on the character generator while I talk. Abe Lincoln. Abe Lincoln. It would do no good. It would do no good. It would do no good to go ahead. It would do no good to go ahead any faster than the country would allow. It would do no good to go ahead any faster than the country would allow. Pretty good, isn't it? It would do no good to go ahead any faster than the country. No, wait a minute, I'm sorry. Strike the last word, allow. I'm reading wrong as I look close at it. It would do no good to go ahead any faster than the country would follow. You take a 1985 frame of reference from America and cram it down South Africa's throat, you're going to have war. It would do no good to go ahead any faster than the country would follow. You like that? Here's the other one. The powder in this bombshell will keep dry. The powder in this bombshell will keep dry. And when the fuse is lit, I intend to have them touch it off themselves. The powder in this bombshell will keep dry. And when the fuse is lit, I see they got it on there. It would do no good to go ahead any faster than the country would follow. Lincoln. Now here's the second one. The powder in this bombshell will keep dry. Semicolon. And when the fuse is lit, comma, I intend to have them touch it off themselves. Don't throw the match at them. You want it again? The powder in this bombshell will keep dry. Semicolon. And when the fuse is lit, comma, I intend to have them touch it off themselves. You like that? Now give me, I've had it. I like it so well, I'm going to wait on a want to know. Now you be watching and helping me as we turn the tide toward sanity and reason.